Hi and welcome. Who's here and how are you doing?
Hi, Doug. Hello. It's Mary Beth.
Mary Beth, hi. What's going on?
Not a lot, sir. I've had a cold the past week, so everything's been pretty quiet on all fronts.
Okay, all right. And I didn't hear who else?
Tisha's on.
Welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great. Any progress? No.
Yeah, no, one thing I just want to say, I hope I'm kind of in a public place, so I just wanted to
kind of in a what kind of
background.
Place?
A public place. I'm, yeah, we have our Super Bowl. This is our Super Bowl production week, so I'm kind of in the midst of that now. So just in case there's background noise or anything, I just wanted to.
Well, I'm glad you were able to join us.
Yeah, me too.
Great.
Yeah, the only thing on progress that I would just say is that I just had it was interesting going through this process for the roadmap process.
Uh-huh.
And I'm looking forward to actually applying it to some other areas that I'd like to roadmap. But it was a lot different than I thought it would be. I just wanted to
Did you find it
that.
Helpful?
In a good way.
You found it helpful?
It was very helpful. It seemed very simple at first when you first sent the sample to us.
Uh-huh.
But actually engaging in the process, I found it to be quite revealing in ways that were unexpected. So, yeah, very helpful.
Good. You know, it's in a way deceptively simple because it's a way to deconstruct a present story and a way to go about constructing, creating a revision or a new story. So it's simple in concept, but the application is difficult. And this group is, I'll tell you, this group is the first group who I have asked to do this. And it just occurred to me, why didn't I ask before? Because it's been I think just a starkly revealing experience and exciting for me to hear how applicable it is and what kind of work that each of you are doing. So I'm very pleased at it being useful and that you're doing it, using it has been helpful to you in the process to further your story, your coaching story. So thanks for that progress note about that.
Thank you.
Sure. Who else wants to check in or give a progress note?
This is Terry Finney. I'm here.
Well,
no major.
How are you?
Thanks.
Are you staying dry and warm?
You know, it is cold. It's really cold, but I'm going to Steamboat on Thursday because the early season skiing is the best it's ever been.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. But it's cold.
Yeah, that's why I go in March.
Yeah.
Well, that's super, though. I know it's been exciting.
Yeah, it's great.
Who else? Any other progress notes or any things to discuss? Anything that's come up as a challenge before we get into the roadmap for today?
This is Terry again. I just wanted to add also the marketing stuff that we talked about last week was really, really helpful to me.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, I know we don't really do much of that, so I wanted to include that. So I'm glad it was helpful. And if there are other aspects, either of the marketing or of the business, that would be helpful, I'll be very happy to address that.
Great. I think that's the hardest part.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it definitely was for me, the marketing part. And the business was fairly easy because I'd done it, but sometimes that's the hardest for certain people who have not set and collected professional fees before or operated their own business who have been on salary. So that's the challenging part. So it really varies, but I think it all is important to address so that you can put the business and the marketing in place to really focus on what you're passionate.
Yep.
And if there are questions about that or anything else that you'd like to discuss, either about the marketing or business, fair game. And I'll be happy to share whatever I know and what I do or any best practices that I've gleaned with each of you as one point of view only. And that's the deal I have with every client that I have in every class is I'll share my experience, not with clients really, but with trainees and with coaches, is that I'll be happy to share my experience if you'll hear it as this is just one way to do things, this is the way Kruger does it, not as this is the way I should do it. So I'll you know, anything you'd like to talk about or any of you who have best practices, feel free to log in. In fact, I'd encourage you to really think about attending the mentor groups, the quarterly mentor groups. They begin, they're the first Monday of each 3 months, beginning like February, April, anyhow. it's in a letter I sent at the end with all of that outlined. And we usually talk about best practices, about the business and successes and that sort of thing. This coming mentor group, we're going to do something different, but it's usually about, we're going to do it as a seminar because I've heard a number of people have certain requests and issues and something that I want to address that I don't think is addressed anywhere in coaching. So we're going to do it as a seminar. I'm going to send a white paper. But usually we do best practices and business and marketing aspects in the mentor group. And that's recorded. So that's going to be something that's upcoming that I hope each of you will attend. Anything else to talk about before we move into the roadmap? Okay, well,
hi, Dave. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Hey, Dave, sorry. This is Jen Powers. Hi.
Welcome. How are you?
Good. I want to apologize to you and to everyone for being such an airhead last week. I was at an exhibitor at a conference on Monday in Indianapolis, and I completely failed to dial in. I'm so sorry.
We missed you, and it's
so
recorded
sorry.
For playback or MP3 download,
yeah.
So you can catch up, and I hope you've had a chance to do that. But yeah, we missed
Thank
you.
Thank you.
You were a notable absence, Jen.
Oh, lovely! Thank you.
How was your meeting?
It was really good. A good conference. Yeah, spreading great. The good word of O-Shift. So, thank you for asking.
Great. Okay. Super. Anything or anyone else before we do our roadmap for today? Okay, Tisha, would you do your roadmap?
Walk sure.
And thanks for sending it around as well.
I'm sorry, what?
Thanks for sending it around as well.
Oh, thank you. And I'm sorry I forgot to attach it the first time around. So this is actually my roadmap. And I wrote her, but I meant me, my roadmap for my reason for living. And I just want to sort of preface by saying that I actually started this a couple of different ways, focusing on different aspects of my life, but it kind of ended up... It may read a little abstract, perhaps, but it just seemed like it was the place to start because everything else kind of extends from this place. So that's kind of why I ended up here. Reason for living, the roadmap to find my reason for living. So recognize authorship. I'm aware that I am the author of my reason for living. I have lived with the memory or story of being a content being mandated to return or reincarnate into this body, this life, with great reluctance. The story began as a dream as a very young child, 4 or 5, and has since become the central theme of my life's personal and professional journey. Own your story. So owning my story doesn't mean denying its origin or denying the dream or its meaning, which was and has remained significant. Owning my story means the recognition of the intense role it has played in narrowing my vision of possibility for myself and my ability to be a fully realized being in this life. Before I move on, I just want to say I didn't go into what the dream was, and I'll just sort of say quickly. When I was a little girl, about 4 or 5, I dreamt that I was in heaven with God above the clouds. And I was very happy. That was the content. That was the content being I was referring to. And at some point,
God took me aside and told me I had to come back to Earth. And I was distraught and I was devastated and I didn't want to leave. I was extremely happy where I was. So he told me that I needed to come back to accomplish two things. I needed to dance and to learn how to love. So he taught me how to dance, and then he took me into the space where I had to select my parents, choose my parents. So I chose my parents, and I flew into my mom's stomach, and that's how I thought at the time I came into being. So this is the dream that I was referring to. And it has played a significant role in my life, as this roadmap kind of speaks to.
Wow.
So moving on to assess plot and storyline. So on paper, I have done pretty well. I've had very positive romantic relationships, some strong friendships, and familial relationships with my immediate family members. I have also had some success in my career and all of its iterations, and there have been a few. However, I have experienced all of the above as an observer rather than a participant. This was a conscious choice justified by my story. Quote, if I don't want to be here, then investing in here has no purpose, which really translates to I am, this life is not worth investing in. The manifestation of this has ranged from teasing myself with the pleasures of life or with life's successes versus really allowing myself to give into them. The almost but not quite girl, kind of how I frame myself. I can track this pattern behavior in both my personal and professional life choices and experiences. It translates to being a shadow of a self. Avoid intentionally not being filled and being completely overwhelmed, often incapable of living with complete fullness when I allow it to occur. The result is I tend to keep people at arm's length. I project a persona of self-confidence, independence, and borderline detachment, with an underlying deep and insatiable passion and intensity that is unleashed and burst when I afford myself the opportunity to truly be in my flow, or I forget my story and I'm fully present. Decide what to change. The phrase that keeps coming to mind is, now what? I am intimately connected to the story's origin, which is a dream. However, how can I transform its meaning to inspire a greater appreciation for this life? I know what grounds me and ignites me. What would it be like to actually give myself these things, knowing that in doing so, I will be visible, I will be seen, I will leave an imprint, and I would have been here. Map changes. Embrace the discipline of my spiritual practice. In this practice, I feel the most connected both in body and mind. This includes seated meditation, movement meditation, and continual study of my Eastern philosophy. I function best in structure. I feel the most freedom and discipline. Create a schedule for myself that incorporates the things that express the fullness of my being. This practice is reinforced with a continual acknowledgement of gratitude for this life, a gift to myself that is an acknowledgement of my ability to be fully realized. I would also develop a varied support system to include a spiritual advisor, a therapist, coach to nurture my journey, remind myself I am not alone, and to promote accountability. Author new experiences. I'm comfortable in this skin, in this life. The portrayal of confidence and self-assuredness is grounded in the true desire to want to be here, fully present and capable of living from the heart, and open and beating heart, adept at giving and receiving in real time. The ability to close the distance between my shadow self and my embodied self, be a greater participant in my life. And then programming new experiences and identity. My identity will be grounded in gratitude for this life and all that it has and will continue to offer, and all that I have and will continue to bring to it. Fear will become a motivator rather than a debilitator. I will trust my choice for returning to life. Life that was key for me. I'll explain in a second, but trust my choice for returning to this life, for choosing this existence, and not allow my reluctance to shape the entirety of my experience. So that's my roadmap.
Congratulations, that's very powerful. What was your most poignant takeaway from the experience of doing it?
I think the most poignant takeaway was that I could actually, well, it was two things. I had a moment when I was writing where I realized my own choice in, first of all, making the distinction between the dream itself and its impact, and then its immediate impact, but then also the story that I thread or that I kind of evolved from this dream that, and that ended up becoming a crutch for me or ended up becoming more detrimental to my own personal and professional growth than I realized it actually needed to be. So I could, then it became, wow, I can transform that story. I could change, but how can I look at the story differently so it's not about, you know, betrayal, you know, needing to come someplace where I didn't want to be, which is really how I actually felt. And I've always, my life has always felt that way, that I didn't really belong here, didn't, because I didn't want to be here. I was forced here. But the reality was that everything is a choice. And that if I look at it as such, even if I look at God as myself and God, and it was my choice to come back here, to experience this new life, it still, it became more empowering and it allowed me to open up the its expression for me. So instead of being constricting and restricting, it became more, more open, and more alive. And that was, I think, the biggest surprise in the process.
It sounds like some really insightful and introspective work that you did a great deal of development story in that process. Congratulations. Any responses or questions or comments from anyone else? Or questions? Well, are you okay to accept any questions or comments from anyone
else? Sure.
Okay.
Hi, it's Carrie Finney. I think that's a lovely piece of work, and I'm curious if there's something that happened other than needing to write this roadmap, if something triggered this for you, if you had an aha experience.
No, I think, yes. I mean, it's probably progressive. I'm sure it's progressive. I mean, nothing is by accident, and the fact that we've been talking so much, the fact that I chose to do this course at this particular time, I've also been doing some work through movement. I'm dancing again in a little bit of a different capacity, movement meditation, but it's so much about, this particular practice is very much about repatterning through body, through movement. And I think on some level I've been kind of chipping away at this for a few years, and then coming to this course is such a sort of intellectual and more literal way of looking at that idea. So I think it's been, the aha has kind of been happening in moments and segments. And but then writing it out, it just almost seems like, oh yeah, okay. Right. It doesn't have to be, before I can rewrite the story or I can rewrite its meaning for me. And that was definitely a huge sort of twist. But a one that I think that has been kind of building up for some time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that answered your question, but.
Yeah, it's great.
That's fascinating. Early in my career, I worked with a dance movement therapist as one of the 9 people in the multi-specialty treatment team for one of the first couple of 3 eating disorder treatment programs in the country. And though there were a number of other specialists, she was the one person who could really connect with anorexics who were near death, who would ordinarily not have been treatable, and she could, in a nonverbal way, engage them. And she was very responsible for us being the most successful treatment team for a 20-year period in getting an American Psychiatric Association award, because she could really connect. And we kind of taught each other. I gave words to what she was doing. She showed me what she was doing in videotapes and work about early preverbal, nonverbal developmental issues that was just really astounding. So I have a deep appreciation for what you're describing and a part of that journey, it sounds like.
Yeah. I'd love to at some point talk to you a little more about that work if you're open to that, that you've done.
Sure, absolutely. We did some national presentation. Did some papers on that. So at the time, this was like before anybody knew what eating disorders were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
You know. Sure. Any other comments or reflections for Tisha? Well, thank you very much. That was very powerful.
Thank you.
And unique and meaningful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else that you'd like to touch on before we move into our material today? Any challenges with any of your cases that you'd like to touch on, or other related aspects of coaching that we could discuss? Well, all righty then. We'll move right into, I'm going to keep the line open, as always, to encourage you if there are any questions or comments or clarifications as we go through this to be sure and interrupt. I want to talk about your new relationship story and really include in that aspects of the coach-client relationship, because there are aspects that I don't see anywhere else that I don't think we talk about in other places that I think are really important. Now, let's think about what really matters. We know the best predictor of human happiness is human relationship, the quality, connection, and time that people spend with family and friends. We know that it's significantly more important than money and somewhat more important even than health. And these findings are summarized in Dr. Dan Gilbert's book, Stumbling on Happiness. Positive human contact, passion, joy, connection, and love create long-term happiness more than any other variable. Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman of Princeton, I've referenced him many times, surveyed over 1,000 American men and women to discern what most correlated with happiness and contentment. Heading the list, nurturing relationships. In a number of studies encompassing people of many cultures, the most satisfying core feature of optimum human experience was nurturing relationships. So let's look at the influence of relationships. Neuroscience demonstrates that emotion can spread from brain to brain. Emotional attitudes, dispositions, states of mind are contagious. This kind of contagion can occur without even people being aware of it. It occurs from brain to brain, from amygdala to amygdala, and motor neuron functioning is involved. And I've alluded to this before. Neuroeconomists have studied pairs of people using fMRI scans of their brain when they were interacting with each other. The brain state and emotion of one is mirrored by the other. When they're in synchrony and empathic connection, there's a brain wave synchrony that mirrors one another. And as soon as one stops listening or there's an empathic rupture, it immediately stops. Here's another aspect of this. A significant finding, I think, by Dr. Nicholas Christakis of Harvard. He followed 12,067 people for 32 years and found the following. And this is just one example of the synchrony of effect. If your close friends are obese, your risk of obesity is 45% higher. If your good friend becomes obese, it increases your chance of becoming obese by 57%. If your friends are obese, even if you don't know them, have never seen them or met them, your risk is 25% higher. Now, these studies parallel the Framingham study in medicine, showing that clusters of friends show a contamination in the induction of obesity. And the examples I gave are just of one variable, obesity. There are similar findings for happiness or unhappiness, drinking, smoking, good nutrition, exercise. There are two or three explanations. One is homophily, birds of a feather flock together, but that doesn't explain it all. A norm or a behavior can spread from person to person by behavioral contagion and mirror neurons. and this is the way Christakis put it, you change your ideal of what is acceptable body type by looking at the people around you or any other behaviors that you look at, what you invest in, what you wear. We imitate the behavior of others consciously and unconsciously. So what can we learn from this social contagion of behavior? One possibility is when someone in a group does a good thing, publicize it. If 80% of a team submits travel reports on time, be sure the other 20% hear about it. If 76% of employees sign up for automatic retirement plan contribution, publicize it. Social networks can influence practices of wealth accumulation to wellness and situations from market fluctuations to product adoption. And Malcolm Gladwell talked about this in The Tipping Point. Marketers recognize this contagion of popularity for commercial products by identifying thought leaders who spread the word and do viral marketing. A couple of other related findings. Light eaters ate more in a group. Heavy eaters ate less. Both eaters conform to the average of the group's consumption. Spending works the same way. A conservative spender shopping in a group will buy more than normal. Being with a frugal friend will cause someone to spend less money. Spending scripts will be modified depending on the group you're with and the group you perceive yourself to be in. Those in a socially affluent group and country club lifestyle will have more difficulty maintaining a frugal lifestyle. They spend money to socialize with friends to a higher degree. The ingrained assumptions and beliefs, for example, about money, the patterns and unconscious scripts that pace consumption are influenced by the context someone is in. Same with nutrition, same with working out, any number of things. Here's one more example. In a study in San Diego, researchers hung four different flyers on doorknobs. They would randomly select and put one flyer, but there were four different flyers. One told homeowners they should conserve energy because it helped the environment. One said saving energy was socially responsible. One said that it saved money. And one said the majority of neighbors in the community were doing it. The researchers found that the houses with the fourth flyer, that the majority of neighbors in the community were doing it, made more difference. There was more conformity to that than all three others combined. Simply urging people or telling them that it's a good idea to recycle or conserve energy was the least effective. Now, let's revisit empathy as a listening perspective and think about it in the context here of relationship. Empathy as a listening perspective inside the experience of another. It's our ability to place one foot in the shoe of another to resonate with someone else's experience, including how that person thinks, feels, constructs meaning, and communicates an appreciation of their style, their personality, work, performance, style. To know as much as possible, in other words, their subjective reality, and not to get lost there, keep one foot in our shoe. So now a footnote here is when someone carefully crafts a speech or tells a story, the art is to allow the emotional response to reside in the listener or the reader, rather than expressing it yourself, or suggesting or hinting how someone should respond to facilitate that person, like the client, to have his or her own experience. We can learn from the poets who give it to the reader or listener to experience themselves. Now, I want to focus specifically now on the coach-client relationship, and I want to focus with you on that. Because, as I said, there are aspects that I don't see anywhere else and I believe are important to you getting, keeping, and benefiting clients. I think it makes a big difference in your effectiveness. Now, we're taught as coaches to address the content, the agenda, intentions, actions, goals, and we've discussed beliefs, behavior, performance. So I want to focus now on the process. It's what happens while you're talking about something else. It's not simple or linear, but our clients will tell us several things in the process, not exactly in words or in constructs. They'll tell us what's most important, what their needs are, what's beneficial, and what's not. For For this, we have to listen very carefully and listen to various forms of communication. In fact, the previously uncoachable client may be one who has been unheard at the level of need expressed, or has subtly gotten the coach to respond in a way that reiterates an old pattern. For example, the coach gets frustrated in the same way that others have in engaging the client. New addition, but the old story. Or a client may recreate the same process as with others. For example, presents confusion about how to proceed, ambivalence with reluctance to move ahead. The coach finally ends the uncertainty and suggests an action. The result? The old story is recreated. These clients may be better understood in a different model that offers a more optimum responsiveness. Here's another example of what I mean by process. Clients know what they need, though not perhaps in conscious, logical, or daytime language. They will try in every way possible to let us know what it's like to be them, to activate the aspects of their experience needing to be addressed in a coaching venue, in a here and now model. They can't help it. It's automatic. It's their attachment pattern. The next mentor group is going to be, I'm going to send a white paper on attachment, because this is one thing that, to my knowledge as yet, has not been applied to coaching, and I think it can be a huge addition. We have to read the client's story accurately and guide the co-construction of a new story. This, I believe, is what Carl Jung referred to when he talked about the strong influence on the children of the unlived part of the parent. Now, we gather as information, not taking it personally, some of these kinds of unspoken subtext from clients. Self-statement, although not directly, I'm sorry, let me say that a different way, although at times directly stated as if it were about us, the coach. A wish or fear. Well, you'll have the answers, or you don't have any answers either. Disappointed recognition. You really don't know what's best for you right now, do you? Hope. You're the greatest. The unspoken subtext, so I too can become great. Feelings. To use as information now and move toward a goal, not to go backward and be understood as if still in an old story, or not to automatically trigger a state change. The second no that always means yes, or one would have been sufficient. As coaches, we listen carefully, simply, literally. Deepest truths are clothed in the simplest of garments. We believe what's said the first time before other words get in the way. We hear somatic language, literally and symbolically. The rumbling stomach that whispers swallowed pain, hypertension, a pain in the neck. The role of storyteller and listener unfolds on the shared lap of the mentoring relationship. Part of the experience of story making is the feel, the safety, the trust, the ambiance of connectedness, the resonance of voice as well as words with a knowing receiver, confidential, collaborative. As Lily Tomlin said, he listened with an intensity most people have only while talking. The message contains the message. The message is a full and valid communication to be understood in its own right before the venue is changed. And let me say a little bit more about what I mean by that. That is, the immediate communication and experience of a client yields initial understanding before looking at what else or what the client is trying not to say or may really mean or where the client really wants to go. For example, often a client will say as a first sentence what she needs to do in that session. I've had the opportunity to see this play out in hundreds of training sessions. And Jen, I'll bet you have too, as mentor coach at Coach Training Alliance. A couple of examples. Well, you know I should just say no and stay on track. But here's the struggle I have with time management. That first sentence is a billboard for an agenda. It's not a drop-off comment. And that person will work the entire session to get back to really take herself seriously about saying no to what she needs to say no to. another example. I worked with an executive who began with, well, I know I'm going to have to dissolve this partnership, but here's the situation. Toward the end of the session, he said, this is great. You've helped me see exactly what I need to do and strategize to end the partnership. I played back for him his own acknowledgement in the beginning, his first sentence of the session, and summarized the process of insights he had through the session so he could really make it his own. My purpose was to help him internalize the process, the model, and take himself as a point of reference so ultimately he wouldn't need me to do it. Now, it's not enough to construct a new experience, or that there wouldn't be a P on the roadmap. And remember, we talked about the most powerful force of the human psyche is to return to our identity. So we have to address that contingently all along the way. We must help a client create and formulate an evolving new model in which to understand and incorporate these new experiences. This new model, this container of present and template for the future, is hope personified. It's a collaborative immersion of mentor, coach, and client. The past and the present are never more distinguishable than at the moment they're juxtaposed. This is the new story, now and next, present and future. Now, as a footnote, I'd like to borrow a concept from psychoanalysis, talk about it briefly to show the usefulness in mentor coaching. Transference is the repetitive ways of organizing current events based on past experience. Transference, in other words, is the organizing process of how we perceive, process, and attach meaning to people and experiences. It simply means we use software developed in the past to read a current experience. So it's the combined neural lexicon of repetition and self-statement. Now, mostly, this is really helpful because it allows us to use vast experience in order to quickly read and respond to situations. We don't have to go through the discovery process each time. But at times, it can be limiting because past perceptions and solutions and the software package developed may be outdated, may have been tailor-made for a past situation. Transference, then, is a playground of repetitions of past experiences with important people as well. The old story will get activated, will come alive alongside the new story being created. So in mentor coaching, we focus on the present, on the new story. We don't bother the old story unless it bothers us. That is, we don't engage it. If necessary, we may address the belief or the assumption of the old story just enough to cleave it from the present, to stay focused on the new, evolving, co-created story. Now, there are a couple of kind of memories that get activated as process. One is explicit, factual memory. The other is implicit. These are procedural, like a relationship pattern, like an attachment pattern. The mentor-coaching relationship will activate the behavior pattern of the client. This offers an opportunity to understand and retranscript patterns of feeling, thought, self-regulation, and behavior. We continually help the client distinguish the old story from the new when the old story is limited in how effectively it works. Here are a couple of quotes from one of my favorite authors that summarize this. The mind is author of internal assumptions, producer of the individual life drama, and casting director of significant others. And the other, models of relationships with others get established very early in life and become the software through which subsequent relationships are perceived, organized, and processed. At least until adulthood, the software is not viewed as one way of looking at things, but as the reality, as the way things are. A fish can't describe water. It cannot get outside the system in order to do so. Now, those are from my last professional book as a psychoanalyst in 2002, Integrating Body, Self, and Psychological Self, Creating a New Story in Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy. And yes, you made the diagnosis of a narcissistic author, one who quotes, basis of what I mean when I say don't take it personally. And the client is always showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. They have a behavior, an attachment pattern of what they're like with important other people. And sometimes that is the problem area that needs to be coached. And it's not going to be something they report. They're not objective enough to report it. They're going to recreate it with you. And this is the challenge of having the working alliance, the crucible, and trust that will hold whatever you need to do and say in order to help the client look at it and craft a different way of proceeding. It takes two real people for this co-created immersion to occur. The mentor coach must come to know how the client feels, senses, perceives, and processes experience moment by moment, frame by frame, the meaning attached to the current story that may have come from the past must be consistently examined in terms of its usefulness in the new story. The only question we ask is, does it work? This also means that the client allows himself or herself to use the mentor coach in a way to simultaneously be inside the old and new stories in this process. Now, I want to pause here. Are there any questions or clarifications about this so far? Is this making sense to you? I want to apply it and look at some real practical applications. But does it make sense conceptually to you so far?
Yes, that's great.
Is there any part that's confusing or doesn't fit with what you've come to know in coaching thus far?
No, Dave, I'm tracking so far.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm
all
tracking
right.
So far. I just I look forward to the application.
Okay. All right, great. Now, let's talk about mindset, because we have a running account of what's happening to us, what it means, what we should do. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. So I want to apply this in very practical ways now to fixed versus growth mindsets. Mindsets frame an ongoing account of how we interpret, how we process, and what we do. Mindsets are powerful beliefs about the stories of ourselves. So let's look at an application here in a very simplistic way of fixed versus growth mindsets. A growth mindset is based on the belief in change. You believe you can enhance and develop yourself. This is what we coach toward. You become open to accurate information about talents and abilities. You use it to adjust to grow. Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, concluded that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have, quote, a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. And this is something we help clients do as well. The growth mindset of learning is based on a belief that basic qualities are cultivated, developed, and evolved throughout life. The fundamental assumption is that everyone can change and grow through experience and application, that you can even change how intelligent you are. Now, let's contrast that to a fixed mindset. And this can not be like a broad spectrum, but you know, somebody can have a growth mindset, except in one particular area, they have a fixed belief. So that's for this, not just the, you know, across the board. Those with a fixed mindset try to make sure they succeed. A consuming goal is to prove oneself in the classroom, later in a career, or in a relationship. The fixed mindset requires proving yourself again and again. Each situation calls for a confirmation of intelligence, personality, or character. The repeated internal questions are, will I succeed or fail? Will I look smart or dumb? Will I be rejected or accepted? Will I be a loser or a winner? Yet with a fixed mindset, no amount of confirmation can dislodge the hypothesis of mediocrity or the need for proof. A fixed mindset makes you preoccupied with how you'll be judged versus a growth mindset focusing on improvement. Now, here are some characteristics that a fixed mindset may share. And any one of these, from my perspective, is an immediate coachable moment. Intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how intelligent you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving that you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem include assigning blame or making excuses. Now, beliefs are usually, especially in this area, are not conscious. Yet, we pay attention to them, and we will hear them from clients. And then we can address them. We can nudge someone toward a growth mindset. What can you learn from them? How can you improve? Here's an illustration of the impact of belief and mindset. 105 Israeli soldiers participated in a 15-week commander training program. In the study, neither the trainers nor the trainees had any idea that a test was being conducted. The training officers were informed outside the participant's awareness that each soldier had been classified into one of three categories of command potential. The training officers were required to know each of the soldiers' personal data and their command potential category. At the end of 15 weeks, the new soldiers took a written test to measure their new knowledge of the variables they had learned in training. Here are the findings. The soldiers who the training officers thought had a high command potential performed significantly better on the test, an average score of 80. The next component, the regular, not the lowest, but the mid component, averaged 65. The training officers' beliefs in the participants made a significant difference in their performance. And the soldiers lived into the belief of them. That's why I think it's so important, one of the most crucial aspects, that we believe in our clients. And for me, I work only with clients in whom I believe. One more example. A group of 51 women were selected to have a short conversation with a randomly selected man. Each man, before calling a woman, had received biographical information, and a snapshot of the woman. Bios were accurate, pictures weren't. Half were very attractive women, the other half, not so attractive, quite ordinary, from what the study read. After the conversation, each man filled out a questionnaire to rate his expectations about the woman. As we might expect, the man who saw pictures of pretty women expected the interactions to be of someone who's a bit more social, poised, humorous, socially adept. The other group of men expected the women to be serious, maybe a bit awkward, and maybe a bit socially inept. Now, here's the intriguing part. An independent jury of totally different people who knew nothing about what was going on in any of the premises heard only the voices of the women from that conversation, and they were asked to rate the women according to just their conversation. The independent jury of men and women rated the women the same as the men attributed. The women unconsciously picked up on the opinion the men had of them and responded accordingly. They lived into the belief of them. I lied. There's one more example. A final example. The same process occurred in a Yale study of senior citizens. This is a powerful and at this point rapidly becoming classic study. In a longitudinal study, those who saw aging as negative, and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over a three-year period of the study. For example, there was a significant drop in the hearing test score equivalent to 8 years of normal aging in the 3-year period that they were measured. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, and even cardiovascular status. This is not an opinion. These are medical measures. It reduces life expectancy an average of 7.5 years. They lived into the belief they had, or they died into it. Now, I want to mention something that it's hard to talk about because there's not really a concept for it, but it's in the arena of instinct and prejudice. I think we have to distinguish our blink, our instinctive thin slicing of data to quickly come to a conclusion, at times from a buried prejudice. Deep within our unconscious, we have connections that can only be called biases, even when we consciously abhor them. We each hold a collection of stereotypical beliefs and attitudes about, for example, social groups that exist often without our permission or awareness. Remember, we download our operating system in the first years of life, 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This addresses a component of it. These beliefs can color perceptions, expectations, and decisions. So this is why we have to be aware of ours as coaches. And they can find their way into the process of the mentor-coach relationship. The assorted stereotypical notions can be about social groups and range from male-female, black-white, elderly-young, gay-straight, fat-thin. Regardless of our conscious desire to avoid the bias of stereotypy, these attitudes can shape the contours of some of our decisions and interactions. So we need to know if these stereotypes are buried deep in our psyches without our permission or even awareness. The meaning that we attach to what we perceive determines its emotional impact. So, by changing the meaning, we can change the emotional impact. With awareness, we can even alter our response to emotional contagion from someone else. The register of social ostracism and rejection occurs in the same node of the brain that registers pain. And of all the biases studied, of all the variables studied to address bias and overcome prejudice, the strongest correlation with overcoming a prejudice is a powerful emotional bond. So there are many learning laboratories for positive connection, including friends, colleagues, mentor coaching. Research suggests, but mostly our experience informs, that we can develop awareness, reshape implicit attitudes and beliefs, and adjust biases. That is, develop new stories ourselves. And I can't quite get the succinctness of it, but Mr. Rogers carried a statement in his wallet at all times. And the statement was something like, "Frankly, I don't think there is anyone alive who, after you get to know them, wouldn't like them." Now, the mentor, coach, and client become co-authors of that new story and create a current meaning that allows distinctness of the old versus new in an evolving new story. We are always teaching others how to respond to us. Your client is always teaching you what it's like to be her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that you can teach it back to her out loud. You must be open to that learning and not let your theories or your agenda get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continuously bridge to the experience, system, meaning of the client. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story. what do our clients want from us? I believe what our clients want from us as mentor coaches is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection so that we can give it back to its creator as self-statement. They want full immersion, us to have full immersion in, yet not full reaction to their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become and see the evolving news story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. To see at times a thought, feeling, or behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I got that from X-Files, but I'm keeping it. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result. To see the hope camouflaged in the frustrating process. To hope that we will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in this process. The architecture of trust silently forms while you talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that he leaves behind, the self of the old story. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. I am astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. Invention has been sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in the old story, repeating the same storylines. We are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. What we do with each client is not about being right, having pristine theory and technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line, does it work? Mentor coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. Hemingway captured this principle, I believe, when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence, no. An ideal co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know, and just a little bit more. This little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, to contemplate, or to celebrate. Now, most of the curriculum is, and for this module, is about working with couples, so I'm not reiterating any of that here except just a couple of things I want to add about working with couples, because I think it's so much similar a process in working groups, the things that that I want to say. So these are just some additional thoughts about working with couples, some considerations I believe are important. The couple, the relationship, is the client. It's not two individuals. It's the relationship. That's your client. There is no confidentiality with one partner regarding the other. There is absolute confidentiality for your client, the couple. Build a holding environment, same thing as with individual work and with a group. A container for the work that is safe and respectful, that houses listening and builds trust. This container requires ground rules and boundaries with active involvement of the coach to establish and to maintain them and to model them. Most important is to establish a process, a format for respect, listening, waiting for the other to finish, checking in, or understanding. We do not advocate for either person, but for the couple. The story that you, if you've read the module, the us story, that's my story. That's my story with my current wife, who I met at a writer's conference a couple of years after my divorce. We developed a relationship over a couple of years and got married at my ranch like 9 years ago. And that was some of our early work, and I wanted to share it. I have only admitted that a couple of times, but I thought they should set the standard here, and many of you have set the standard with your roadmap. So that was kind of an ersatz roadmap. We listen for strengths to build on, to use for repair. We counter the number one defense couples use of blaming each other by holding the couple accountable and responsible to be respectful in the relationship. Mentoring couples includes the fundamental components of individual coaching, though focused on the couple as the unit, the relationship itself as the client, and the basics. Establish the coaching alliance, the working alliance, maybe create a vision, develop an action plan, implement the plan. The mentor must also appreciate, and this is important, the developmental evolution of a relationship, as well as the stages of development of the relationship and how they parallel the individual developmental stages of growth. For example, a relationship could be in its very early phases. One member of the relationship could be in a midlife phase, and another member could be beginning a later developmental era in his or her life. So we're looking at different developmental phases and how to blend them and how to look for the cohesiveness and the us, the superordinate relationship that's there that both can aspire to. For a couple, both external core issues and internal core issues affect the couple. So be very aware of that, and especially things that have an impact in a different way, perhaps, depending on where someone is developmentally. Parents, family members, children, career, money, religion, neighborhood. Internal core issues include matters like ideals, individual styles, temperament, health style, you know, personal habits, that sort of thing. So those are the things that I wanted to review about couples' relationships, and I want to leave the remainder of the time open for discussion and questions, just for any aspects of the relationship component, which you've really been talking about, and to see what kind of questions or thoughts or experiences that you have about the process, the attachment patterns that you see in the coaching experiences, and your thoughts, ideas about that.
Dave, this is Jen. I really, really love this piece. It's so interesting, especially the bits earlier on about the influence that our beliefs in our clients can have on them. Uh-huh. And I've been saying that I don't know how I got to be such a believer, but I am really, really a true believer in the people that I work with. And I've never really had someone that I didn't believe in, so that's interesting for me to ponder that, you know, like to really work with people who you believe in. And I'm like, huh, I wonder if that's ever been true. But there's one case that I wanted to ask you about, and that was just recently I was speaking to a former client. She was interviewing me for one of her, you know, little a podcast or something. And in there she spontaneously came out with the fact that why she stopped working with me, like why we finally, you know, she said on, you know, you were my coach, that, you know, Jennifer was my coach and blah, blah, blah. And that one of the reasons why she stopped working with me was because I believed in her so much, that I had such a belief in her, that she was afraid that she wasn't going to be able to meet my expectations. And I thought that was really interesting because it was almost like the belief in her was backfiring. And I kind of want your thoughts on that, because it gave me pause, because I'm always like a big like fan, you know, I'm always like letting them know that I'm cheering them on and that I believe what they want is totally within their reach. And then this was, she felt like she was going to let me down.
Okay.
So, like maybe she...
Let me focus, and that's a great example, by the way. Mm-hmm. And let me focus on the principle, and then I'll share a hunch with you, okay?
Okay.
The principle here is, I'll bet that you did not have specific expectations of her, because that's not what a belief is. A belief
mm-hmm.
is the knowing that someone can live into and fulfill their hopes, their dreams, set their goals, and do that, and you're believing in that process and the possibility of someone doing that. You're not
mm-hmm.
running in plays. You're not creating expectations.
Right.
Now, so, and I'll bet that was what we would see if we were to carefully look at everything. Now, my
mm-hmm.
hunch is that something about this process for her got scary because she was further than she had ever been. And there was something that was scary about the possibility of moving ahead into totally new territory. And
yeah.
that scared her enough to stop her. And, of course, that didn't make sense in any way, consciously or logically, to her. So why not, you know, say, well, it's because you believed in me too much. I had to stop, you know. And it makes stopping make sense because we have a need in our minds and our brains to bring closure, whether or not it's accurate, whether or not it's cause and effect. But, you know, so if do you think that might be anywhere in the ballpark?
Yeah, that hunch is a good one. And I think I've been someone who has tried to find something else to justify why I'm not doing something further, you know, so that makes a lot of sense. And the first part is really, really true, too, for me, in that is the difference. It's not like believing in you is different than having a set of expectations that you're going to, like, not meet or let me down on, you know? So, yeah, that's a really good reframing of that, Dave. Thank you.
Now, as you look back at the time that she stopped, were there any hints that might have been coachable in retrospect about her stopping, or was that statement when you did the interview a total surprise to you?
Yeah, it really was a surprise. However, there was a sort of a push-pull, you know. It wasn't her just like other clients where they push through, you know, and they're moving forward. It was always like a little two steps forward, one step back with her, two step forward, one step back. So,
yeah,
that didn't really make sense now in hindsight.
Yeah, show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire, as we've talked before.
Uh-huh.
And that duality is always there, and it sounds like it was there regularly with her. And then when she did stop, she didn't own the creation
yeah.
of the obstacle, but saw it in an externalized way.
Which is easier, yeah. I'm very protective.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So is there anything that you dare do now to communicate with her?
Well, she has since hired me again, so she's come back on, and I think I want to do something differently. My first tendency was to be less of a positive cheerleader, which is really not in my nature, you know? I mean, I'm not like sappy therapy, you know, Dave. I'm like, I really believe what I say, and it's real.
Yeah.
But then I started to question, you know, like, well, is this serving this particular client as well
look
as my other clients?
Look
yeah.
again at the, first of all, don't change. That's your magic.
Right.
Don't
yeah,
change.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
keep your magic and don't, you know, keep
mm-hmm.
that magic polished and
mm-hmm.
crystal clear. Look again at the white paper that I sent on desire.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Because I think that one thing that could be revisited at some point, and there may be an opportunity for this, and I was thinking along the lines of if the podcast was the last contact you had, of mm-hmm. saying something to her like, you know, I really have been thinking about what you're saying and wondering about your perception of my belief in you. I have a total belief in you and in your capacity. I also believe that there is in you, as in everyone, a push and a pull. As we move ahead, we relinquish challenges. There's the duality of sometimes a desire and an obstacle. And I think that is an issue that might well be addressed in order for you to soar even further in your
mm-hmm.
successful journey. Because she brings closure to it by saying, you believe in me too much, goodbye. But she's reopening it now. If I were pressed, I would have put good money on that because she hasn't found anybody, nor will she, who believes in her totally, unambivalently, as you do. But she's
mm-hmm.
going to come back. Now, you let her come back without writing a goofy letter like I was suggesting, but she came back in a natural way, so you have an opportunity to think about it in this way and to listen for any manifestation of how she may limit or put a little bit of a glass ceiling or muffle in a little bit of a way her own experience of success without downloading that experience to change her identity, because that's the issue here, is to evolve the model of how and who she sees herself to have that success and that identity evolve to parallel the success that she's creating and to incorporate the belief in her that you have to believe in herself. That's a new experience in the completeness that she's experiencing it. So that's going to have to be addressed at some point because her attachment pattern is different. You're changing a fundamental identity for her, and you're changing an attachment pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get any more bedrock than that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking about her and her specifically, and that really, really makes can explain a lot of things. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I can explain a lot of ways that I've seen her show up and things that she said or, you know, even just recently. Because we did have a brief conversation about this, but not one, not maybe deep enough before setting into the next round of coaching. So, yeah, and it's not too late. I can still do that.
Yeah, yeah. And think about that model of that someone can be totally free to have a desire as long as an obstacle's in place. And the obstacle can be even superficial, like looking at the scene you don't want to look at but yet are drawn to look at by covering your face but then, you know, creating
yeah.
a little slot so you can
yeah.
look at it between your fingers, you know.
Right,
so
right, right.
Look at her doing and undoing, you know, moving ahead and takeaways, even if they're subtle, even if they're in jest. But just the subtleties of that, that's where it's going to show itself because it's going to come alive in the process with you again and again. And that's a great example of exactly what we were talking about it's not going to be out there. It's going to be
right.
in the process with you, and it already has been, and it is in
yeah.
the process with you. That's where the impact and the power is going to be because it's between the two of you now, which is which is terrific. It's the most challenging, but the most powerful.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's a beautiful example of exactly what I was talking about how things come alive in the relationship, how she lives out her experience with you, recreates the attachment pattern she has with herself and with other people with you.
Mm-hmm.
And don't leave out the with herself, because you came to represent that part of herself that she said, well, that's enough right now. I've got too much of this good stuff. I need to take a break. So I'll see you. Oh, by the way, you believe in me too much.
Isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
Good. Really helpful. Thanks, Dave.
And think of yourself, and this is important, when you think of however you think about transference, don't think of yourself as like a sister or like a mother or like a father. Think of yourself as a function, because she's not far enough along to be differentiated to be object-specific, if that makes any sense. But think of yourself as a function of something that she can't quite do or be herself. And how, by functioning for her in that way, you give it back to her so that she can own it, incorporate it, and do it and be it, ultimately, herself and self-regulate. Because this is an issue of regulation. And regulating, staying with success. When you've got feeling bad down, the hardest thing in the world is to stay with feeling good.
I like that.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. That's a beautiful example, and I appreciate you bringing it.
Yeah, you
so
bet. Thank
we're
going
to have to stop here. And we are, let me see where we are. I'm kind of off on our, we will meet next week for our for number 11 next time. We'll meet for seminar 11 next week. Have a great
rest of
the week.
And then we have one more after that, right, Dave?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
All right, thank
after
you.
After the holidays.
Okay, great.
All right. See you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye.